A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on August 19, 2001, entitled God Naturally. The texts for the sermon are Ezekiel 1, verse 26 through chapter 2, verse 1, and Revelation 4, verses 1 through 11. Copyright Grand Valley State University.
I'm not going to read from the present reading. You can do that on this rainy Sunday afternoon, but to recommend the book, Tomorrow's Catholic, which is written by Michael Morwood. It's written, addressed to the Catholic community, but could be addressed to any solidly traditioned community, and calls for the translation and revision of the understanding of the faith with new images in order to connect with our contemporary human experience. I printed in the underneath the sermon title the text from 1 Kings 19, that very familiar experience of Elijah and the encounter with God, that God was not in the earthquake or in the fire, but in the sound of sheer silence. Richard Elliot Freeman, an excellent book, The Hidden Face of God, speaks about how God's voice is heard less and less, and God's action is less and less, as more and more responsibility is shifted to the human as you go through the Hebrew Scriptures. And he points to this as one of those remarkable examples of the sheer silence, indicating that God's voice should not be expected in the spectacular, but rather in the quiet, that now it is the human responsibility to move on. I suppose you all check the Grand Haven Tribune, if you get it, to see what the sermon subject is going to be the next day. I don't know why we still do that. I don't think anybody really cares. How many of you do? I'm not going to ask. But we do anyway, and if you did and you saw the printed subject title and you thought, that's going to be a rip-roaring sermon, I'm going to go tomorrow morning. Well, actually, the words are right, but the punctuation's wrong. If you read the Tribune, it said, God, comma, naturally. And so you might think, well, Dick will raise some question to which he'll give the old cliched answer, as he always do, God, naturally. Whatever question might be, the answer would be God, naturally. But when I turned the liturgy in, I turned it in correctly. And just to show you how naturally one might think it would be God, comma, naturally, Carol called me and she said, Dick, don't you want to comment there? I said, no, I don't want to comment there. But Jane didn't call me. So we had it right in the liturgy. I don't want to speak about God naturally. I want to speak about God naturally. And there's a big difference. I want to speak about God in the ordinary human experience. I want to speak about God as a part of the reality into which our lives are woven. I want to speak about God in ordinary terms. I want to speak about the God who is experienced in the one single realm of reality into which everything is connected. Thinking about God is always a challenge. And to try to express that reality that has been represented in that little three-letter word, God, to try to say that in a new and fresh fashion is not so easy. In the book Tomorrow's Catholic, Michael Morwood points out the fact that our images of God, our understanding of God, comes out of the biblical tradition, that those images were born in ancient cultures, people who, like us, tried to figure out the meaning of life and who they were and who God was. And so it would be perfectly understandable, if you stop to think about it, that we would have to find new images and a new way of expressing that same reality, because our world has undergone a total revolution in understanding of the reality of which we're a part. The biblical view was represented in those throne visions that were read a little bit ago. There hardly is language to describe the grandeur and the glory and the awesomeness of this Almighty One who sits on the throne. And yet remarkably, in Ezekiel's vision, that which is revealed, the revelation, is a human face. And of course, the revelation that John received in the Isle of Patmos, which again is expressed in all of the exalted language of that fourth chapter and fifth chapter, that revelation ends with the New Jerusalem coming down out of heaven from God, and God dwelling with God's people, God being with them, so that there is a coexistence of God and the human in that recreated heaven and earth. And the supreme point of revelation for our story, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, the humanness of Jesus. So we're not really so far from that which is already hinted in the Scriptures, but certainly the conceptions that with which we have been nurtured are images and conceptions which need translation, particularly in a time like ours when we have undergone now for some 300 years this exploration of the cosmos, of natural reality of which we are a part, and we have come to see the total interconnectedness of the whole of reality, and therefore our images of God somehow or other need to find ways to express that new understanding of the world of reality. And so the old supernatural theism doesn't really do it for us. God, some supreme being with independent existence, totally apart from creation, who creates as a master craftsman or an engineer, putting the world together, and then continuing to sustain that world, involving in that world through intervention here and there, now and again. That idea of a God out there beyond us who has to dip into our reality, that's hardly the picture of the reality that we have from all the knowledge we have from the natural sciences. When the scientific method was first birthed and the data began to come in through the use of the empirical method, those who wanted to hold on to God and to faith moved to a conception of God as the supernatural creator who made it all and then wound it up like a clock and sent it ticking off on its own through the operation of natural law. They were called deists. In the age of reason, the time of the constitution of our own country, those people were deists. They were very reverential over against God and certainly adored this awesome being who created and then set to spinning on its own the worlds, the planets, etc. But the deists had no God of intimate relationship and experience, and it didn't carry the day very long. And so there have been all starts and stops and movements throughout these past 3 centuries, 2.5 centuries. But finally, we come today to an understanding of the natural world, of cosmic reality, which enables us to envision God more naturally, to envision God as woven into the center of our being. And so it's time for us to think again about how to express in a positive fashion the reality of God in our present human experience. Bonhoeffer tried to do that when he was in prison, incarcerated for the conspiracy against Hitler's life. He had time to think. He was a brilliant theologian. He was struggling in that existential situation, imprisoned, his life in jeopardy, the great movements across Western Europe. And he began to write, and his letters from prison indicated some of his ruminations. He began to speak about a religionless Christianity. He could see Western Christianity failing, because in the last three centuries it's not been good, frankly, for the Christian tradition. We've lost the argument again and again and again. Bonhoeffer began to speak of man come of age. He spoke about how God is being edged out of the world. And then he criticized the clergy who, losing the battle on all of the fronts of discussion, of intellectual discussion, would finally come down to the matter of sin and guilt and death as their little private domain. And Bonhoeffer said, I don't want to talk about God at that point in human existence, in the weakness of humanity. I want to talk about God in the strength of humanity. I want to talk about God at the very center of the life, not on the borders, but as is the church, in the very center of the village. And so he, of course, could never complete his own project, but he too was striving to say, how can I say God? How can I say Jesus Christ? Confronting the human being come of age with all of his knowledge and all of his prosperity and all of his power, how can we say God in such a situation? Probably the cosmologists today are the most reverential group, standing perhaps in greater awe than the theologian. Because the real miracle, as it becomes more and more uncovered, is the miracle of reality itself. The miracle of this cosmic reality of billions and billions of years, with its creative emergence coming finally to creatures like us. The miracle of life, the miracle of birth. The wonder and the awe of our human experience. And there is an openness and a discussion today, a conversation about how we can say God. Because what has happened over the last few centuries, as the church dug its heels in against the forward march of understanding and knowledge, was that many of the most thoughtful people simply dropped out. They became unaffiliated, not necessarily lacking spirituality or religious fervor, but nonetheless unattached to the institutional forms that continued to operate on, well, what is still operative today in so much of the church, a 17th century paradigm of God and world. And so many had to become just a naturalist or a materialist who said, there's nature and nothing more. But today there's a new possibility. And there's new conversation. And those conversations are bringing to expression a fresh appreciation for the presence and the reality of God, not somehow beyond our human experience or beyond our world, but woven right into the midst of it as the creative spirit, the source of the creativity of the ongoing unfolding miracle. Back in May, there was an issue of Newsweek that spoke about religion and the human brain. That's one of the frontiers of exploration in our day. I understand that within the last year or so, MIT was given $300 million to study the relationship of brain and mind. And this cranial cavity is a meaty computer. And it's quite a marvel. It operates with chemicals and electrical charges and hardwiring. It's an amazing thing. And yet, there's something more than this meaty computer. We speak also of mind. We speak also of consciousness, of spirit. Consciousness, mind, spirit, which rises out of this meaty computer in our cranial cavity. And what is the relationship between the brain as a physiological phenomenon and the consciousness, for example, of us sitting here talking about it and thinking about it and speaking of God this morning? Well, there are those at very respected academic centers who are intensely engaged in trying to track what happens in that meaty computer when a person prays. Some nuns who pray well, some Tibetan monks, they actually were wired up. And it has been demonstrated that in the midst of deep meditation, when that moment of movement into, well, not being a mystic, I don't know how to explain it, but the sense of unity with all things, the descriptions of that moment of moving over the threshold into that meditative state of pure consciousness are absolutely beautiful. The loss of fear, the presence of light, the abundance of love. Those experiences that are documented by those who are serious in their meditation and in their prayer, that now has actually been mapped through the injection of dyes into the brain. They've actually been mapped to indicate that there is indeed the map of that pure consciousness, which the mystic would say is God. And the Newsweek article ends, of course, by saying, this doesn't solve anything if you want to know. I mean, this is not now scientific empirical proof of the existence of God, because the debate will go on. Does the brain create God? Or does God create the brain that can experience God? Well, most of us would fall into the latter camp, I hope. But my point is this. That experience is not foreign to our human experience. To experience God thus is to experience God naturally. It is to experience God in the natural realm. It is to experience God in the only realm there is. This realm of which we're a part, whose mysteries we have only begun to unravel. What we know is absolutely amazing, and it is probably only a fraction of what there really is. But my point is this. We are now coming, perhaps, to be able to think of God naturally. I suppose that, for me, that is important, because as I was nurtured in the idea of God or the experience of God, God was other than this supernatural being, this one from whom I was fallen, alienated, this one who held me to account, this alienation necessitating somehow or other a reconciliation in order that I might, at the end of this veil of tears, enter into the presence of God eternally. It was like this present human experience was only kind of a testing ground and a proving ground. It was not an end in itself. Here we are sojourners. We have no lasting dwelling place. And God is alienated. I can remember feeling uncomfortable with the fact that St. Paul said that the natural person is at enmity with God. At enmity with God. I thought, I'm not at enmity with God, but yet that's what Paul said, so it must be true. I must be at enmity with God. Well, it feels a lot different to me to think of myself as a part of the whole cosmic scheme of things, into which is woven as well that creative spirit that nudges and moves things along, and that is accessible to me. Not as the enemy, not as the alienated one, but as the source of love and grace and life. Gary Everly, in his Geography of Nowhere, speaks about the importance of ritual, tying it to some of this physiological talk about the brain. We know now that not only deep meditation, but even the participation in the ritual of the church can trigger some of that stuff in the brain that creates a sense of wholeness. And that so many who have been totally divested of any kind of experience of the sacred live fragmented lives, insecure, often fearful, failing to find meaning. Gary Everly suggests that it is in the ritual practice where the mind is bypassed and somehow or other the depths of the being are touched, that we have the possibility of the experience of God. Naturally, a gesture, space like this, a ritual, a word, a song, the opening notes of the organ, which cause my goosebumps to have goosebumps. Whatever it may be, however it happens to you, it doesn't matter. We all are so different. But that somehow or other, to have an awareness that the sacred and the holy is as intimate as our breathing and as available as taking that time to be present to the mystery that is God. I want to speak of God naturally. I want to have the experience of God in the totality of my human experience. I want it here. I want it now. And by opening myself up to you, and to silence, the sound of sheer silence, or wonder of wonders, if ever the heavens should open and I should have a vision. But it will not be of a vision of another realm and a being out there, but it will be that inward sense that all is well. Come what may, in face of human tragedy and loss, in face of the totality of human experience, all will be well. Because I've come to know God naturally.